Since we have an hour, I will speak briefly. And if anyone would like to share anything, you're most welcome or ask a question. Through the senses, we hear, see, speak, taste, and touch. So let's say you're hearing someone and you're intently listening to the words. You feel, I am hearing this person speak. Or I am seeing things through these eyes. I am tasting something through the tongue. And so on. But we don't question who is this I. We assume it is this me with a name which is seeing things in the world, listening to people, without realizing that it is consciousness which is listening to people, not the individual. Consciousness is seeing things through these eyes. And consciousness is tasting food through the tongue. Which basically means if I was not conscious, I would be dead. In which case, I could not hear anyone, see anything, speak, taste, and so on. If we are able to live this truth, that it is pure consciousness, which is my true nature, which is functioning through me, as well as others. And if my relationship is one of consciousness to consciousness, I would find most of my problems disappear. Because consciousness is pure being, which the child is. The child has not developed a mind and a sense of separation. It is natural. It is the natural state. It is functioning and operating in the natural state because it has not been conditioned by life and therefore has no judgment. This pure being of the child, pure consciousness, is what one could call a state of love, a natural love, not a give and take love. The child has no idea really, so it sees everyone quite equally. So it is being itself, its natural self. The child allows people to be as they are because it knows nothing else. It is incapable of wanting people to be other than the way they are. Isn't that love? The Bal Krishna roop Krishna, which means Krishna consciousness, as the child, means this only. So the spiritual journey is the rediscovery of that child which we were, but which got covered in the duration of time once we became adults. This child which got conditioned to believe it had to protect and defend itself in this harsh world, and try to compete with people, try to enforce its opinions. This battle to survive started becoming a huge burden on this child. As a child, there was no fear of death, because pure being has no fear of death. But when the ego steps in, the ego, this sense of separation, this is me, this body, this mind is me, this ego is afraid to die. So what has happened? One could say the heart which was wide open, the heart of consciousness, flowering naturally in the child, got covered by the veil of the mind. That veil became so thick that instead of being loving, which is its nature, it wanted to be loved. A total reversal of nature. Now the quest is to be loved. I want people to love the clothes I wear. I want people to love my views about politics and to agree with me. I want to be socially active so that I win the approval of others and they see how nice I am, how good I am. This is what is called Maya. And the spiritual journey is reverting back to the child that one was. Rediscovering the self. Rediscovering that everyone I meet in life is an instrument of the same consciousness. Some are designed a certain way, others are designed another way, based on their genetics, their life experiences, their conditioning, which they had no control over, just like I didn't have control over mine. When this is realized, when this is recognized, then my relationship reverts to a relationship of consciousness with consciousness. Now, I don't have to strive to win battles. I don't have to consider people being for me or against me. Now, I am willing to lay the guard down. Now, I am no longer polarized. Even the words right and wrong, the polaric opposites, lose their meaning. Because I am right based on my view, my conditioning. The other person is right based on their conditioning. So who is right and who is wrong? So the need to convince others, my view is the right view, drops away. Yes, I am free to express my view. But beyond that, do I really need to hammer it down on someone else? And so when the wisdom teachings come in, that is the rebirth of the child, the second birth. One is the biological birth and one is the spiritual birth. And that is a gift. That is a tremendous gift. The second birth is not everyone's destiny, which Lord Krishna himself has said. There are millions, but only a few are on the path, and a few of those know me by name. Now, this journey, this spiritual birth, is the rediscovery of that love of Krishna, which is a divine love, transcendental love. Not a give and take love, not a barter, not an exchange. It is not a clingy love, it makes no demands. It is simply allowing people to be the way they are. That is all. So it is perceived as a cold love. But it is the opposite. It is the ultimate bhakti, because God's creation is acknowledged for what it is. That is called divine love. Because you are looking upon the people in your life, those you love and those you don't, as being created by the same force. You are no longer looking at people as being apart from God, and you have no longer split people up into good and evil, polaric opposites. So those on the spiritual journey need to be cognizant of this fact, that if they are still compartmentalizing people in their life, then the teaching has not gone to the heart. The sage makes no distinction. The sage may have a preference, no doubt. But there is no distinction and no judgment on anyone. That is the love of the sage. When we start living this love, we will be surprised to find that even those who have troubled us, unlike earlier, we now send them a silent blessing and say in our minds and hearts, that just like I am facing challenges in life, so too you must be. Maybe different sets of challenges, I don't know. And may the Divine, the Almighty, be with you through life's journey. In this life, you and me have some friction. That is the destiny, that is the blueprint. But I wish you well. I don't wish harm on you. I certainly wish we didn't have that friction, but it is there. That is the nature of the Rinanubandhan, the karmic bond. So be it. All we can do is try. So I have released the other person. I have unchained the other person. Because I have seen the hand of God above them. And when I release the other, I release myself. That is the end of the karmic cycle. I have learned what I had to in that relationship. Nothing more is to be learned. The rin is over. So when I sort out these relationship issues in life, which is the core of this teaching, because all relationships are a reflection of my relationship with myself. Whether it is my relationships with people, my relationship to what happens in my life, even that is how I relate to it, relationship. Pleasure or pain, relationship to pleasure, relationship to pain. And my relationship with myself, do I love myself or hate myself? It is about relationships because this is the realm of duality. Two, relating to something, to people, to what happens, to myself. And the teaching of Advaita says not to. Advaita appears as to, not to. As the American mystic Joel Goldsmith says, to give up the belief in two powers. There is no power apart from God. Because if on one hand you say God is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-merciful, and then you act as if people are independent entities apart from God, there is a big paradox there. Staring us in the face. So you see, when we are true to ourselves and realize all this, these illusions drop away. You find your mind starts becoming quieter because a mind without judgment, condemnation, hatred, malice, pride, envy, jealousy, guilt, shame is a vacant mind, a quiet mind. The wheels are no longer turning like they used to. You will find you have less to say. Because so much you said was based on the illusion of doership and separation. Now what is left? So a transformation of thought, word and deed takes place. Your words change. Your thoughts change. You know, it is rightly said that supposing you meet someone and you really dislike that person for whatever reason, you needn't even say anything to that person. That person will feel it because we are vibration, vibrational field. People will sense that we dislike them. So thinking, अरे ये आदमी क्या है यार छी, in my mind all those thoughts, but I'm pretending, it's not going to work. Because consciousness is all there is. Its ears are wide open. So, it is your thoughts about people, not the words you say to them, or what you think about them, alone. The content of your consciousness determines your relationships. It is tackled at that very root. the quality and content of your consciousness? Is it a healed consciousness, or is it imbued with toxicity, negativity? Because consciousness is pure. What you put in is what you get. You think the world is full of enemies, the world will present you with enemies. If you disapprove of people all the time, not only will the world present you with people to disapprove, but people will disapprove of you. As within, so without. That is the law. What has happened is, you see, this one self has been very naughty. It cannot be seen. So it makes us stand before a hall of mirrors. What happens if you stand in a hall of mirrors? You should be seeing yourself in all the mirrors, because you are standing before the mirrors. In the hall of mirrors, it is logical to say that when you present yourself and stand there, you should see your own reflection in each and every mirror. But in this life, the self stands before the mirrors and sees others, forgetting that if I don't stand before the mirrors, I can't see any reflection. So whose reflection is it? I have to be there standing in front of the mirrors to see the reflections, which is what I see. But the Maya is I'm seeing other people, not realizing I'm seeing myself as others. That is the Maya. Because if you saw yourself, would you hate yourself? Would you hate anyone? If you just saw you everywhere, then there's no question of any two emotions, because you are all there is. But when we see others, that's when this drama begins. And this endless drama can take lifetimes. Right till the last breath in this life, in this very life, you are carrying resentments, hatred, condemnation, condemning people for having done things to you, and wanting to get back at them till your last breath. Revenge is sweet. And so on, which perpetuates this bondage. This bondage is perpetuated, and we keep falling into the action-reaction loop because of this unconscious behavior, which destroys our peace of mind. And when our peace of mind is destroyed, we destroy the world we live in. It's in shambles, tattered. We are now beacons of destruction. We want to rain hell down on someone who has been unjust to us. We don't realize we are fighting a battle with ourselves. And so on this quest, with these realizations, we start finding, or rather discovering, that peace. That natural state of peace and harmony, equanimity and calm, that is our inherent nature, which certainly cannot be found when we are too busy targeting people in our lives, dominating them, controlling them, and feeling insecure, wanting other people's approval, and so on and so forth. These very tiring games of the ego. When we allow God's creation to express itself the way it has been made, without placing demands on it, we find we are more and more at peace. That peace which we all know, because we all in deep sleep, we know how beautiful deep sleep is. Because in the morning we wake up and say, I slept very well. You slept well because you were absent in deep sleep. You didn't even know you exist in deep sleep. So your absence was so peaceful. That is everyone's experience, that you are most at peace when you are absent. Isn't it a joke? That is God's greatest gift, deep sleep, to prove to us that the absence of the ego is peace. But to find that in the waking state is the sadhana, the journey. That these teachings, those who are drawn to, it is the path of knowledge, which is not knowledge with the K lowercase, which is just information, but with the K capital. That K capital of knowledge is the knowledge referring to consciousness. And the sages of India, right from Ramakrishna, Sai Baba, Ramana Maharshi, and so on and so forth, have constantly pointed to this Brahma Gyan. You see? But we can't run after them wanting miracles in our lives. We also have to do our homework. We feel we are entitled that we go in the embrace of a master and surrender and everything will be done. But it is not so, because we have to live the teachings. You cannot ask for grace and surrender and not be a living example of your master's teachings. So on the path of Gyan, the path of knowledge, it is called Gyan Tapas. That everything in life, in the day, I look at what has upset me, have I upset other people, what is behind it, that is the sadhana. Where did I lose my peace? Why did I lose my peace? We have to reflect and contemplate. And that's why the sages are looking for these kind of students. who are being earnest. Results are not in anyone's hands, but earnestness is the key, as Maharaj said. Sincerity and earnestness, even that effort, that I know how precious this gift of peace is, and this is my quest for it, and not to destroy other people's peace. Because I know how precious my peace is, and I'm going around destroying other people's peace. So that is the sadhana. And this rediscovery of the one heart, not two individual hearts, two physical hearts, because the same consciousness is pumping through both hearts. To rediscover that, when I resolve this whole issue of relationships, then my relationship is heart to heart. Not mind to mind. Heart to heart. But this riddle of relationships needs to be solved first. Then, when it is understood, the awareness sinks into the heart, leads to a change of heart. Hriday parivartan. The heart has changed. The heart which had kind of closed has now reopened. That is what happens. So one has to be afraid. One is first afraid to die, and now one has to be prepared to die. The ego has to be prepared to die for this heart to open. What does that mean in simple terms? This sounds too elevated for us. A simple thing. You watch a movie, you love it. You tell your friend, "What a great movie I saw." And your friend replies, "Really? I hated it." So you get very upset. You have no taste. You don't know anything about movies. But if you are prepared to die to your opinion of the movie and you accept maybe someone else loves it, let me see why they love it, or let me see why they hate it. And to be open means I've died a small death to my opinion about the movie. I've realized it really doesn't matter because it is my individual opinion and it's not the truth. I'm released of this. You see, this is how the ego dies little deaths. Gradually. And life becomes so beautiful. It becomes a revelation. So like this, little by little, my heart starts opening. The opening of the heart. The heart of awareness. Because I am aware that everything is a grand show. One big movie on the screen being projected by consciousness, all characters played by consciousness, the director is consciousness, the producer is consciousness. And consciousness is watching the movie through my eyes. That is it. So a deep peace and a change of heart. When that happens, then when it is your last day, whether Shiva comes before you or Krishna or Ganpati or whichever your preferred deity is, and you say, in this classroom of life, I hope I learned the lessons I was meant to learn well. And no matter what I saw, whatever happened, I thank you for giving me this opportunity to understand and grow. That would be a life well lived. Because we are here to learn lessons. This is the Mrityu Loka, the Loka of death. So we must learn about death, otherwise why are we here? You go to a commerce college to learn commerce. You go to an arts college to learn arts. You go to a science college to learn science. You are sent to Mrityu Loka to learn about death, and we run away from death. Means we run away from class, we don't want to study, we don't want to pass the exams, we run away and then we have to redo the entire year, then we complain. So we are sent back again and again because, boss, what are you doing? Your attendance is needed. If you run away and escape, I'm going to keep repeating that class for you, isn't it? So, better to learn about it, not be so morose and sad about it. Because death is not really the death of the body. It is the death of what I thought was me and mine. That is it. My job, my family, my car, my friends, my clothes, and so on and so forth. It is the death of that. Identifications. The death of identifications. Your most cherished object in your life, a beautiful watch, a piece of jewelry, you forget about it in deep sleep. So how precious is it really? It is precious because you've assigned a value to it, either an amount or because someone you really love gifted it to you. My watch. The poor watch has not said anything, but we have said it is mine. We've not asked the watch, whose are you? Whom do you belong to? Would it say to you? So we have acquired mine. And the sage knows everything is theirs and yet nothing is theirs, because this is a transient show. Here today, gone tomorrow. What troubled you in the morning no longer troubles you in the evening. That's how transient the show is. You forget. If you have a challenge in the morning and you have a worse challenge in the evening, you'll forget about the morning challenge. And you'll say, I wish I had only the morning challenge. That is how fickle life is. If your loved one gifts you a watch worth 50,000 rupees and next year gifts you a watch worth 5 lakhs, you'll forget the 50,000 rupee watch, you'll give it away to someone. You see? Because we have attached value. But if we see everything as an expression of God, then this game is up. We have seen through the illusion. We have torn apart the veil. Actually, life is not about you and me. It is about me and me. Me and me expressing itself through the other. Absolutely crazy. It's an absolutely crazy life, which we are trying to make sense of. Why did people do things to me? What did I do to deserve that treatment? The analytical left brain mind. But when you realize that most of life does not make sense only, then you start living. Then you really start living. Sometimes my teacher, when people would complain in front of him, why did God do this to me? Why did he grant me such a destiny? Sometimes, when he felt perhaps it was needed, he would lean forward and say, why not? And that person would be stunned. And then he would say, that how can a created object know the will of the source? So these why questions have to be dropped. How many why questions are you going to ask all your life? Which troubles you only. You are seeking answers you will not get. So better that the questioner is dropped. When the questioner is dropped, there are no questions left to ask. And to accept, thy will be done. When you start accepting this, you become a beacon of peace yourself wherever you go. Because now you bring that peace along with you. Earlier, you were a bundle of contradictions and troubles. Now it is the opposite. New people come into your life. Old people say something has changed about you. Some may even say you become very boring, which is a supreme compliment. You see? Because you are no longer entertained by the drama of life, so you become boring. But your peace is found within. You are content. Let the world find you boring. He'll stop inviting you also to their parties because you hardly speak. You are such a bore, you don't drink. So be it. As Lester Levinson, the American mystic, said, socializing is looking for love in the wrong place. You see? So, this is the inward journey. No longer the external, no longer the outward. Let it fall apart. Allow it to go instead of holding on to it. Because you are insecure. Would anyone like to share anything?
Hello. There's this teaching of Manonigra where we are required to control our desires and mind, right? And then there is this non-doership. So I personally find it contradictory or paradoxical. Kind of, is it not, you know, imposing your ego onto controlling certain things that may be very natural to you, and then, you know,
so see, this is what happens when you cross-pollinate. You have to see which of the teachings on desirelessness appeal to you and go with that. In this teaching, a desire is witnessed as a desire arising. And this example which I've given very often, which my own guru used to give, that let's say a man comes home after a hard working day, sits back and just requests his wife to get a can of beer from the fridge. And she goes and realizes there's no beer. And she tells him, sorry, there's no beer, we've run out of it. And he says, oh, let's call the shop below and get it. And the shop is closed. Now he starts getting upset and agitated. And he tells his wife, are you so silly? You didn't realize that it's out of stock and you didn't even get it from the shop, and now the shop is closed. Now the pursuing of the desire has happened. The pursuing of the desire is causing suffering. In a sage, the desire will arise. The sage may also feel like, I feel like having a can of beer. It's been a hot day. So the arising of the desire is witnessed. But what is also witnessed is that the beer is not in the fridge. The sage may yet say, let's try the shop below. Why not? Desire fulfilling it. Oh, the shop is also closed. Thy will be done. So the desire is not pursued to the detriment of others and myself. The ordinary person pursues the desire and invariably harms the other or themselves. That is the difference. Because it is natural. Desires are a natural part of the functioning. So, witnessing the desire is what takes place. So, you have to see if it appeals to you or that part's concepts on desire appeal to you.
Thanks.
That is why Maharaj said something which sounded very cryptic. With no desires, you're dead, but with low desires, you're a ghost. Which basically means, with no desires, you're dead. That is why Ramakrishna, when his wife got upset with him about eating mangoes, he said, be very careful, because the day I stop eating mangoes, in 3 days, I'll be gone. So the desire for the mango was holding him down to this plane. And what is Maharaj pointing to? Low desires which are unfulfilled and the body is no more. That bundle of desires is still there. Only the body has been dropped. And then you're stuck without the body. What is a ghost? Spirits is this only. Vasanas and sanskaras, which are so intense, have got disembodied and they don't know what to do. People get stuck on this plane because they are not willing to let go. Anyway, Yes.
Yeah, when we all know that die will be done, why do we put so many efforts to acquire something or do our best to get something when we know die will be done? So why do we go around doing all that? Let us be inactive and wait for what has to be done will be done.
This is the age-old defense mechanism.
Okay,
If
now
it is
if.
in our nature to be active, we will be active in the pursuit of the desire.
Okay.
Just like Krishna told Arjuna, if you have been designed a warrior, trained as a warrior, conditioned to be a warrior, you are designed to fight. It is your
Correct.
natural state to fight. The problem is, you assume you are the doer, and that is why you are saying, I will not fight against my preceptors. But it is I, Lord Krishna, who as time have already killed them. You are just merely the instrument through whom the killing will happen. So if I am designed to make an effort, it will be made, because not to make it is inverted doership, because I am now acting against my nature. But now the effort will be made knowing the results are not in my control. When I understand, all I can do is try, put in my best, but thy will be done, which has been my life's experience. I've
But then
never
why should we
got.
try?
Try not trying. See if that
Difficult.
works for you. So, as my teacher said, in the morning when you wake up, tell yourself, I'll try and not take a shit today.
Okay.
Try
Okay.
it. You will be made to go to the bathroom. You see?
That's our nature.
Yes. But we are freed of this my doing. We see the effort is there, the striving is there, but it is not mine. I was designed this way. And you know what? A beautiful thing happens. When I see people who, unlike me, who is effort prone and driven, are lethargic and lazy, I don't hate or blame them. I say,
That's the nature.
that's the way their
Yeah,
nature
they
is.
are. That's the way they are.
I may wish that they were more active,
Active.
but I know that's their destiny. Who am I to compare themselves to me?
Okay.
So I leave people be. That is all.
Very well explained.
We don't know what makes people lazy or lethargic. It could be genetic. It could be life's experiences or form of depression. There's so much we don't know. But we judge by the tip of the iceberg and then label people. How do we know?
So we should not comment on that. We
It's
should
not
not.
about should not. This is the revelation. Everything is unfolding as it is. People are as they are. Who are we to want them to be another way?
No, I mean, sometimes our children are lazy, not doing homework, going for a video game. So
Yes.
then I can't just
Of course,
make.
because you are the role model for the child.
Role model the child,
So
right.
you
So
have
I
to
have
do
to.
what you feel is best for the child. Yet, as Rameshji would say, the parent who is on the spiritual journey knows that all children come with their own destiny. So that parent will not compare, judge harshly, force a child down a certain path, because that opening is there. And the best way is to lead by example. The child learns through the example of the parent. That is the best way, not to be told what to do.
I would just want to share something. I have been interviewing for jobs lately, and I used to have a desire to work in a certain company because I like the kind of work they do and everything around that. The interview started becoming stressful because I really wanted to be there. The desire was really driving me. And then I started sort of designing my responses around what the interviewer would want to hear, right? And then I thought in my mind that the interview went well, but in the heart of my heart, I thought something is off. And I did not clear the interview. So today, I mean, literally today, I decided I would just not prepare anything. I'll just be, I'll respond. I'll just respond to my work. I wouldn't prepare for the interview. I know the kind of work that I've done. I'll respond. So the interview went well. But the best part of it was I wasn't really concerned about the outcome. I was just so peaceful, just responding and seeing what had happened rather than sort of trying to be something. That I'm not really detached to if I would get there or not. I'm just happy it's done and it was peaceful.
Yeah, and die will be done.
Yeah.
See, it reminds me of two things. One was a friend of mine who's no more, who started the anti-terrorist squad, the first anti-terrorist squad, Khan Saab. He was very controversial in his time. He loved English literature, English language, the English poets, and he was that kind of a man. So he had this vision to be an IAS officer. But his mother wanted him to enter the police force, IPS. So his mother forced him to sit for the IPS. And he used to tell me, he said, "Gautam, I tried my best to fail, but I passed." I tried my best to fail. He entered the police force. So we don't know what God has planned for us. You see, we just don't know. Now, another thing I remember, since you mentioned interviews, I was in Sydenham College. I forget, there was a student body which many students were vying to get into. The interview process was very hard. You had to be so sharp in your answers. And this, I don't remember the exact number, but this student was asked a question by the panel. And you are given 1-2 seconds to answer. The question was, right now, above Mumbai, how many crows are flying in the sky? So this boy answered, 3,782. Get this, one question is asked. You have one answer to give. It cannot be the wrong answer. Your pass-fail is based on this one question. How many crows are there in the sky? 3,782, whatever. So the panel was wonderstruck and asked the boy, "How do you know?" He said, "Sorry, you said only one question." And he got admission. You see? So when we give interviews, knowing that all we can do is try, all we can do is our best, we release this fear psychosis. You know, because we want that job so badly. We bring this whole feeling into the interview. See, I did a course, a Tibetan breathwork course, with its origins from Padmasambhava. So there was an English man, Edwin John Dingle, who was stationed in China, and he went to Tibet and he met a Tibetan master who taught him the breathwork. And this was the master of masters. He could pick up soil in the palm of his hand and seeds, and a plant would sprout all in 5 seconds. So after he trained Edwin John Dingle, he said, "Now your role is over in China. You have to go back to the States and teach them." He said, "How can I? I mean, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist. I'm based in China. That is my life. I found my way to you." He said, "But know this. Your station is already decided. Your station is already decided." Which basically means whether you get that job or not is already decided. But because we are operating in linear time, we can't see that decision. So all we can do is try our best, knowing that whether or not we have got it is already decided. That is why a new example which I came across, I use often, when Ramana Maharshi assigned the building of the ashram buildings to Annamalai Swami, Annamalai Swami said, Bhagwan, there's so much work to do, so many buildings to be built. His answer was, Bhagwan said, these buildings have already been built. It is predetermined. But Annamalai Swami said, Bhagwan said that, but yet before each and every stone I placed, he would say, where are you putting this? Is it the right size? It should be this way, not that way. Because that is the manifest world, the doership, so to speak. But to know that it has already been decided frees me. Then I am in the working mind mode. Because my thinking mind, which is invested in the imaginary future or living in the dead past, is disengaged. Then I can really bring full attention to the work. That is what happens. Like being fully present at the interview, but not sitting as far as the results are concerned somewhere else while giving the interview.
The Mrityulok example was beautiful. I'd never thought of that before. And I was just wondering if you could just share a little more, because it just opened something in me and I was very curious what that did. Like once you did that with Rinanuband, it's the same thing I experienced, because Mrityulokyam, you know, it's usually a taboo subject. Like, but I find it fascinating that if you can see it as a classroom. And I was almost wondering if Yam is a guru of that classroom. And if I want to work with Maya, let me also understand what Yama is. It just, I felt something move in that direction. So yeah,
yes,
just...
but like I said, this is not the death of the body. You know, sometimes we are trying to learn about the process of death, dying. We are too fixated on the body dying. This teaching says the body doesn't care whether it lives or dies. It is the ego which cares. Body is the body. It's neutral. It knows nothing. So the ego is targeted, because if the ego has no fear of death, then it's really living. So immortality is to live in the present moment. Moksha, liberation, Mahamrityunjaya is what? To be free of the fear of death. Death is death. But death is a monster because of the one who is afraid of it. And the one who is afraid of it is a piece of fiction. Why? Because it disappears in deep sleep. So how real can it be? Consciousness, impersonal consciousness, becomes personal in the waking state. It in the deep sleep state, it is impersonal. Impersonal means no person there. Becomes personal in the waking state. So that personal consciousness, identification, that identification is the problem. So the mrityu is of the identification. That is what it is.
Pranam Gautamji. Actually, like you mentioned about this ego being dead, or basically like that's the one which is worried about the death. I think daily we are sleeping and getting up. So
You don't have to think. Yeah. You are sleeping.
So in that whole process, yeah. Right. So in the whole process, like when we are sleeping, it's a deep sleep. That is, ego is not there. And when we're getting up, how quickly it comes in, nothing we even don't know, right?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
So that, is it possible that somebody, something like, at least now we know that there's a, like, we think about that. It's ego which is getting up. So I know, again, it cannot be controlled, but is there any process like in that moment, like it can be smoother, because it comes up immediately, like you want to do something immediately.
Ego will come up because that is the functional element in daily living. You have to be the ego to function. But what doesn't arise with the ego by and by is the sense of doership. I am the doer. I am the karta. Then just the pure ego will arise. That is why Rameshji would say that even Ramana Maharshi responded to his name being called. He wasn't sitting there like a zombie. Because the functional ego is there, right? To function. What happens is the thinking mind of the ego doesn't get up in the morning then. That monster which comes rushing in, when the thinking mind is disengaged by and by gradually, then the pure ego, functional ego is awake. Because it is an aspect of consciousness only. Impersonal in the deep sleep state, identified in the dream state and the waking state. Now the dream state, no matter how bad your dream is, you're so relieved in the morning it's over. But this waking state is a problem because it has a sense of continuity. I'm waking into the same dream in the waking state every day. The same job I don't like, the people I don't like. So dreams, no matter how bad, it was just a dream. Who cares? The sage says that about the waking state, that this is just the living dream of life. So the sage is no longer that perturbed and disturbed by the events in the living dream of life, but he is also a human being. He knows pain will have to be faced, but there's no psychological suffering beyond the pain. Pleasures may come his or her way, but there is no pride or arrogance. The sage knows the nature of life is duality, sometimes pleasure, many times pain, and the boat goes through the river of life. So the sage is going through this journey in a lighter way. That is all.
You said about desire to be loved is also part of ego. It comes from the ego. But in my experience, I see it is there in the child also from the very beginning. So when does it start arising? Is it like out of fear, or how does it form? And because it governs a lot of our things in life.
This baby, which is pure being, is assigned a name by its parent. There is no desire to be loved in the baby. When the name is assigned and the baby is prompted by the parent to react to the name, that is the start of the formation of the ego. That is itself the start of identification. The start of suffering is there. Then, because that sense of separation has set in, that baby wants attention. It does things. You know, you see babies putting their finger in sockets. Why? They are now wanting your attention. They want to see you react. They are now mesmerized into being the center. This is me. And I have the power to make that thing react when I do this. Power, control. That's it, comes into the baby. Can you see how absurd it is? And then the parent tells the child, do that and don't do that. So now the child thinks, I'm a doer. Earlier I had no idea about this damn doership thing. Now I'm being told, do this and don't do that. The birth of doership takes place there. So the doer is infused into this child. You know, there's that meme, I don't know if you call that a meme, there's the photo of a dog. And the dog is saying, my name is, he says, I'm a bit confused. Sometimes they call me stop that and sometimes they call me get back here. So what are we called? You see, this name we are given, this response mechanism, this sense of doership is the birth of the ego, which now wants to be loved. Because if I am no longer the center of attention, what will happen? If I'm ignored, it means I don't exist. Imagine a scenario where the parents name the child, want the child to respond and do goo-goo, coochie-coochie and all, and the next day they ignore the child. What confusion there will be. This child will think, now I don't exist. That is the fear of death. Because I was made to believe that I exist. So that pure being, I am, the impersonal awareness of being becomes I am so and so. That is the one afraid to die. I am is not afraid to die. But I am so and so apart from you, that is afraid to die. So we are designed to fear our death. Such a joke, right? Why did God really trouble us like this, you wonder? I mean, that is why they say God is a sadist. But this is how we discover God only. The discovery of the self. You know, at the end of Rameshji's life, he refused to get into any questions about, like, you know, your body is withering, dropping away, what do you feel? Someone asked him when he was very frail. And I burst out laughing because I found it very funny, but I knew it was a very serious topic. So someone asked him right towards the end, what do you feel about death? And he stopped for a while and he said, look here. You're sitting here, you see a cockroach going by, and you stamp on it. So what was a live cockroach is a dead cockroach. That is what I feel about death. I couldn't control my laughter because I saw this person wanted the highest gyan, and this is all he got. That was really incredible. And the poor fellow was left with a dead cockroach, basically. You see, because he would constantly say the human intellect is too puny to know the will of God. And he would say, a painting can never know why its painter painted it. Can any painting know why its painter painted it? It can't, because it is the created object. How will it know the will of the creator? Then for the next 3 months, if I saw a cockroach, that would come up in my mind. Amazing. So I would say, to wrap it up, go easy on yourself, go easy on others. We are all carrying the same crosses, the same burdens, but some are given the gift of the spiritual journey to make unconscious patterns conscious and to see that others are suffering unconsciously, not out of their choice. So then qualities like the compassion of the Buddha start arising. Or as Eckhart Tolle says, the felt oneness with being, because it's a shared journey. We are all in it together. Appearing as different beings. So we go easy, go lighter on people, ourselves, to just also enjoy this journey of discovery. Don't make it a burden on yourself. Okay, thank you.